Okay, is this recording?
Yes.
Great.
Okay, so this is our third, right? It's our third installment on Rashi, and this is going to be a combination of history and learning, as we might not have done in the past. You know, the first week we did more history. I think last week we did a little bit more learning oriented. This week we're going to actually do a mingling of the two, because our topic this week, as you could see on your source sheet, is Rashi responds to Christian interpretation of Tanakh. Now, I keep telling everybody that you can come to each individual shiur without having heard a previous shiur. So this week, that's not entirely true. We're building slightly, maybe a little bit more than slightly, on what we spoke about last week. So just, you know, a quick run through. Last week we spoke about the fact that Rashi's commentary on the Torah, and we looked primarily at his commentary on Chumash last week, and again, we looked at things that pertain to the Parsha, but we looked primarily at his commentary on Chumash to see that we tried to address the big question of what exactly is Rashi doing in his commentary on the Torah and his Perush on the Torah. What is his goal? What's he trying to achieve? And we said that what he's trying to achieve is actually the subject of debate amongst interpreters, modern interpreters of Rashi. We spoke about the position of Nechama Leibovitch, very famous and very influential, who said that Rashi is primarily, almost exclusively geared towards interpreting the text, and even when he quotes a midrash, his goal is to really make you think about the difficulties and the ambiguities within the text of the Torah or the text of the Tanakh itself. That's Nechama Leibovitch's position. We said that there are people who go to an opposite extreme and say, no, that what Rashi is doing is primarily giving you an ideological, pedagogical, theological commentary on the Torah. And then you have positions in the middle that seem to be the most likely, which is that Rashi has an educational agenda. He has messages that he wishes to impart. But he does that by staying fairly close to the Torah text, so that when he quotes Midrashim, he doesn't quote the ones that are like furthest away, the least likely Midrashim. He quotes ones that are roughly connected to the text of the Torah that he is commenting upon, and by so doing, he makes a running commentary on the Torah. Now, that obviously is a necessary background for our topic this week, because if we are to assume that Rashi does respond to Christian interpretations of Tanakh, we have to assume that Rashi's agenda is not exclusively exegetical, meaning it's not exclusively to comment on the text itself, but that Rashi has an additional agenda, namely to make Jews think about Tanakh in a way that obviously responds to or somehow excludes the Christian commentaries on the Tanakh, on the Torah, on the Nevi'im, on the Ketuvim. And we're going to see this evening that this is expressed in Rashi's commentary in a number of different fashions. And we're going to see also that sometimes Rashi attacks frontally and sometimes he does it a little more subtly. And so and of course, again, some of the ambiguity remains. So let's first talk a little bit of backdrop here. Why is it that Rashi would feel the need to respond to Christian attacks on the Jewish people? And why would he need to build that specifically into his commentary on the Torah, on Navi, on Ketuvim? So the answer, of course, has to go a little bit to the culture of the interchange between the Jews and the Christians when we get to the 11th century when Rashi is around. A little bit of backdrop. So we mentioned in the first class that the fact that the Jews of Ashkenaz, of France and of Germany, are living in Christendom, they're living in a largely Christian area, obviously has to play a very, very important role in our understanding of how the Jewish community in France evolved, and of the background, therefore, to Rashi's life and to Rashi's intellectual and literary endeavor, to what it is that Rashi is doing. And so understanding that the church is a very, very powerful entity, and understanding that the fact that the church is a very powerful entity is going to lead, maybe occasionally, maybe more than occasionally, to some kind of clashes with the Jewish people. So let's talk just again very briefly about some of those clashes and about the nature of some of those clashes in order to understand what it is that Rashi comes up against. So the truth is that if you want to say confrontation, you know, again, it's built into the Jewish and Christian encounter almost intrinsically because Christianity grew out of Judaism. So it had to define itself against Judaism, like we spoke about in the first class, and it had to contend with the fact that Judaism is still here, that Judaism is still very much present, and we, the Christians, are in power, they, the Jews, are not in power, and how do we deal with all of that? And of course, as I mentioned in the first class, there will be different times and different ways in which that's dealt with. But specifically, attempts to convey Christian messages to Jews with the clear attempt of converting Jews to Christianity. That begins in France and in the Ashkenazic areas more broadly in Germany well before Rashi is born. Again, we said Rashi was born in 1040. That's in the, let's say, the middle of the 11th century. We already know that by the 9th century there are attempts by church members and you know, Christian Catholic intellectuals to refute Judaism, to look at Jewish claims and look at Jewish ideas and to try to explain why they're wrong and why the Catholic Church is correct. And again, that sometimes takes the form of, you know, just simply a written treatise, a written tract, or whatever it is against the Jews. But that even that goes even before the 9th century. So Christian writers are writing, you know, are trying to refute Judaism before Ashkenazi period, before the Middle Ages. That's been, again, from the beginning, as we said, because of the nature of the relationship. But the idea that the Jews should be compelled to engage with this, by which I mean preaching will be done directly to the Jews, that's taking place in France, again, in the centuries before Rashi is born. Again, whether it means that books are being written to refute Jewish claims, whether it means that there are forceful attempts to convert Jews, whether it means that sermons are being delivered in synagogues, right? Sometimes the Catholic clergy the Jews are being compelled to allow the Catholic clergy to enter into their shuls and to preach to them and to deliver the message of Christianity to them. These are all part of the, again, you know, not every week, not every day, but these incidents are flaring up occasionally throughout the early Middle Ages. Again, the 9th century, the 10th century, the 11th century, when Rashi is living. And we know that the pressure for Jews to convert to Christianity, for Jews to convert to Catholicism, again, we talk about Christianity in the Middle Ages, in France and Germany, we use Christianity and Catholicism interchangeably, right? So we're talking about the Catholic Church. And the pressure, there was intense pressure for Jews to convert. How do we know there was intense pressure for Jews to convert? Because we know from Jewish sources that there was a large number of Jews who did convert. They converted maybe for economic reasons, maybe because they felt the pressure for ideological reasons, maybe for social reasons, but we know that there was a lot of pressure for Jews to convert, and a lot of Jews succumbed to that pressure. When I say a lot of Jews succumbed to that pressure, let me give you an example of a Jew who succumbed to that pressure. We spoke in our first shiur, when we were introducing Rashi and his background and his teachers, we spoke about the great luminary who preceded Rashi in Ashkenaz was Rabbeinu Gershom Maor HaGola, right? Rabbeinu Gershom, the light of the exile, the man who created Ashkenazi Jewry, whose students became the great sages of Germany, and who the reason that Rashi traveled to Germany in the first place was in order to study with the students of Rabbeinu Gershom. And we have from Jewish testimonies that Rabbeinu Gershom's son converted to Christianity. How do we know? We know because the testimonies say that Rabbeinu Gershom sat Shiva for his son who converted to Christianity. One interesting question that's not entirely clear is when he sat Shiva. Meaning, did he sit Shiva when the son converted to Christianity because he felt now the son is lost to him and that's it? Or did the son die and Rabbeinu Gershom sat Shiva for the son who had converted after he died? These are sort of an interesting debate in terms of understanding the nature, what exactly that statement means. Rabbeinu Gershom sat Shiva for his son. But, you know, even though it sounds a little bit arcane and a little bit technical, it actually is important, that little debate, because Rabbeinu Gershom, we also know from his writings, is leading the way for a Jewish response to the problem of mass conversion. I didn't give it to you here, but I often, when I was teaching in Frisch, I would always read to my students a responsa from Rabbeinu Gershom. The question that was posed to Rabbeinu Gershom was, a Kohen who converted to Christianity and now wanted to return to Judaism, can he continue to function as a Kohen? What's the question? Well, what's the backdrop of the question is an indication in earlier sources that if a Kohen engages in idolatry, if he worships idols, Avodah Zarah, he's not permitted to function as a Kohen. So the question was posed to Rabbeinu Gershom, here you have a Kohen, he converted to Christianity, now he wants to return to Judaism, and can he get the first aliyah in shul? Can he duchen on occasions when duchening takes place? And Rabbeinu Gershom answers, yes, if this man returns to Judaism, he's back to being a Kohen again. Now, I want you to understand the significance of this in two ways. Number one is you have to understand that for the Jews of Ashkenaz, we have all kinds of explanations and all kinds of interpretations, in which we kind of try to fudge the possibility of Christianity actually being Avodah Zarah, right? You'll see that today we have all kinds of reasons to explain why we don't believe that even Catholic Christianity, with its belief in the Trinity and its employment of images and so on, is an actual form of idolatry. But we see from the writings of the Ashkenazi Jews in the Middle Ages that they were not as politically correct as we are, and they regarded Catholicism as idolatry, hands down. And so to say that a Kohen who engaged in actual idolatry would be permitted to return to function as a Kohen, that's a big deal. Again, to contextualize, you go a little bit further down the line, a little bit further down in history, and geographically to a different location, to a location in which there aren't many Catholics. You go to the Rambam, and the Rambam, who is writing in the Muslim milieu, tells you that if a Kohen goes off and worships idols, no question about it, that Kohen has lost his status as a Kohen. Even if he returns to Judaism, he can no longer function as a Kohen. Conversation over. Rabbeinu Gershom, on the other hand, writes a lengthy responsum saying, if the Kohen converts to Catholicism, now he wants to do tshuva, he wants to come back to Judaism, we reinstate him as a Kohen. Why? So he goes, he has all kinds of lengthy explanations, but the punchline, the bottom line is, because we want to encourage as many converts as possible to come back to Judaism. And if you exclude him, if you tell him that he can't continue serving as a Kohen, then you're giving him the message that he's not fully welcome in the community, that he's lost something of his kahuna, of his status, by converting. And then what's the incentive for him to come back? We need to incentivize it for the Kohen to return. And the incentive is a seamless reintegration into the Jewish people. You're back to getting the first aliyah, you're back to duchening, you're back to doing everything that you need to do, because we want to encourage return. Yes. Let me just get to
the question really is, would the response that I've been saying, had they not been living at a time during, a period where Christianity was trying to convert many of the Jews?
Right.
The conversions happened all the time, but would his position have been any different?
Okay, so for those at home, Steve's question was, would Rabbeinu Gershom's position have been different if he was living in a time or a place where conversion to Christianity was not as rampant? So, obviously it's hard for us to say, because we know where he was living. So that's why I quoted the Rambam for you, because I think that's an interesting contrast. The Rambam is living in a Muslim culture. And for the Rambam, and for most Jews, there's no question that Islam is not idolatry, right? Islam believes in one God, they have no images. So there's no question that Islam is monotheism, so that a Jew who worships Islam might be abandoning Judaism. They might not be, they might not be following halacha, but they're not actually worshiping Avodah Zarah. As opposed to Christianity, with its, again, with the belief in the Trinity, with the Eucharist, with, a lot of concrete things that make God seem very real. For Jews of that time, there's no doubt that Christianity is Avodah Zarah. So we can't say for sure what Rabbeinu Gershom would have said, so that's why I contrasted him to the Rambam on one hand. On the other hand, what we do know from his writings is that he's explicitly saying, we want there to be an incentive for people to do tshuva, because there are people who have converted and do want to come back, so we want to incentivize tshuva. That's what we know. So that's what makes me think that... Or not just me. I'm just quoting other historians, right? Other historians. I'm not a historian. I'm quoting historians to say that that's seen as a response to the culture of the time. Yeah, Mary.
What year was that?
So Rabbeinu Gershom is roughly, he died less than 20 years. He died within 20-something years of Rashi's birth. So we're talking about like one generation roughly before Rashi. So again, we're talking about, the late 10th, early 11th century. Yeah.
They lose their status.
Okay, so that's so Betsy asked about Kohanim who marry those who have converted to Judaism. It's true. Now, part of the background to that is the assumption that there's no such thing as converting out of Judaism. So even if a Kohen went off to become Catholic for a year or 2 years or 10 years or a month, he never stopped being Jewish. He was just a Jew who was going to church for some period of time, as opposed to somebody who was not born Jewish and converted into Judaism, where they actually went through some transition. And that's, again, that's exactly the point that Rabbeinu Gershom is trying to drive home. We don't regard this person. Again, Rashi's going to reflect this in his Chuvos, and it's going to be reflected throughout Ashkenaz, right? This idea that they quote from the Gemara, Yisrael, afal pi shechata Yisrael hu. A Jewish person who sins is still considered to be a Jewish person, which is largely seen as a response to the phenomenon of large-scale conversion to Catholicism due to whatever the pressure might be. That's what it comes down to. Now, one of the ways that one of the means in which the argument is made, one of the ways, in other words, that the Catholics try to convince the Jews that Christianity, Catholicism, is the true religion and Judaism is wrong, is through the interpretation of Tanakh. And again, this goes back all the way to the beginning of the Catholic Church. You will find, or the Christian Church, before it was officially defined as Catholic, you will find that they're writing commentaries on books of the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, in which they try to show you how those books should be interpreted allegorically as referring to Christianity and Jesus and all of the developments that are going to come subsequently. In other words, what they're trying to tell you is that the Jewish Bible is not meant to be taken literally, and it's meant to prefigure Christianity, and it's meant to show you that, you know, that all their arguments are true. Now, in order to do that, they have to argue and they have to interpret the Torah and Nevi'im and Ketuvim allegorically, meaning, when we say allegorically, we mean not literally, right, but as one thing standing for something else. Or sometimes they, you know, you could read the way they interpret it, and it's not drastically different than the way the Jews interpret a midrash, in a midrash, I should say. Right? So let me give you an example. The word Mashiach. What does the word Mashiach mean? The word Mashiach means Messiah, right? That's the way we normally interpret it. The truth is, the word Mashiach literally means anointed one. And that's important, because who was anointed? Kings were anointed. So, and we're going to see this when we actually start looking at some of the sources. The word Mashiach, therefore, when you take it literally in Tanakh, can refer to someone who was anointed. It could refer to a king who was functioning at the time that book of Tanakh was being written. But very often, the rabbis will say, well, the word Mashiach clearly means the Messiah, that future redeemer, the king who will come to redeem the Jewish people. Right? Now, you're put in an interesting position, and we're going to address this at length going on. But the interesting position, the interesting predicament in which you find yourself is that if the Jews could interpret that as referring to a future Messiah, what's to stop the Christians from interpreting that as a future Messiah? And in general, there are plenty of passages in Tanakh that can be interpreted, according to Christian theology, as referring to various tenets of Christian theology. So, what does that mean? What that means is, if you are a Jew, and part of the way that the Christians are trying to bring their religion to you is by showing you that your interpretation of your Bible is wrong, but that your Bible, your book, actually tells you that you need to believe what they're believing, so obviously part of your endeavor needs to be to show yourself and them and your community, certainly people who may be impressionable, that actually what your Bible says is not at all what they claim that it says, but it actually means something completely different. It means something Jewish that doesn't have any Christian message or Christian meaning to it whatsoever. Now, that's important backdrop for Rashi's commentary on Tanakh, because, like we said, last week we started talking about the fact that Rashi, A, might have some educational theological agenda, but B, when we saw his grandson, Rashbam, we saw what he wrote about Rashi. We also said that Rashi, because he was very connected to the text and because he did respond to textual questions, he and certainly his students who came afterwards created a whole movement to explain the Torah and Tanakh according to its simple meaning, without Midrashim, right? Without going back to the rabbinic writings. And we saw that Rashbam is willing to completely jettison Midrashim in his interpretation of Tanakh in a way that Rashi himself was not willing to do, even though we saw also last week that Rashbam claimed that Rashi himself said, oh, if I had time, I would have gone back and I would have rewritten a Perush that had less rabbinic material and more Pshat material. In short, after Rashi, we have a whole movement of people who are looking to interpret the Torah according to Pshat. Now, historians ask, and we've addressed this on a couple of occasions, and I think, Mary, you asked this question last week, what is it about this moment in time that is generating this particular approach to Tanakh? And so, what I said last week and what we continue to say is that it actually might be a number of factors. But since we're talking this week specifically about Rashi's response to Christianity, I should mention to you that there are some historians who read Rashi's interpretation of Tanakh, whether it be Torah, Nevi'im, or Ketuvim, as absolutely and exclusively geared towards refuting Christianity. That the only agenda that Rashi had was not to teach you how to read the Torah, and not to teach you what the words mean, and not to give you theological beliefs about Judaism or about mitzvot or whatever. Even though he does all those things, the agenda that underlied that was his desire to refute the Christian reading of Tanakh. And when it comes to Rashi's students who are, again, writing these simple meaning, plain meaning, pshat interpretations of Tanakh, that's their agenda as well, is to refute the Christians. How does that refute the Christians? Well, the answer is, look, if you have the Christians who are coming to you and interpreting the Tanakh as prefiguring Christianity and Jesus and various Christian beliefs, so you basically have three possible approaches you could take to refute this. You could take a head-on, frontal attack. You can go after them and say, you're wrong, we're right, here's what's wrong about what you say, and here's what's right about what we say. And there will be people who do that. You can take a more moderate approach that's still kind of attacking them, which is, you know, not frontal, going after them, addressing their concerns directly, but still addressing their arguments or giving interpretations of the Torah that are not according to their arguments. And then you could take a much more subtle approach. What's the more subtle approach? A more subtle approach is simply not to mention them, not to address them, not to allude to their arguments in any way, simply to interpret the Tanakh in a way that shows that they are wrong. And so those historians who say that Rashi and all of the students who followed him, who wrote these pshat-oriented, again, these simple-meaning-oriented commentaries on Tanakh, what they're saying is, what's the point? What's the point of those interpretations? The point of those interpretations is, if someone is interpreting the Torah in a way that, or again, any of Tanakh, in a way that you think is wrong, all you have to do is interpret it in the right way, and then you can get rid of their interpretations. But it's more than that. It's more than that. It's not just interpret it in the right way. Because once you start quoting Midrashim, once you start quoting sources that interpret the Torah allegorically, or that interpret the Torah as, you know, the words say one thing, but it refers to something else, you're still opening the doors for the Christians to say, well, it is referring to something else, just not that thing that you think it's referring to. You know, a friend of mine told me that back in the late 90s, my friend lived in Muncie, so he told me he was driving on, I forgot where he was driving, a thruway or Route 59, I forgot, some road leading to or in Muncie, and there was a big billboard with a picture of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, and a caption that said, right idea, wrong man. What does that mean? It means that this was put up by some Christian missionary group that was saying, we also believe that the Messiah is here. We also believe that you know, the Messiah rose from the dead. We also believe in all that. You guys are on the right track. You just kind of, you know, have the wrong dude attached to who that track, you know, to who the actual Messiah is. And in a sense, once you start interpreting Tanakh allegorically, once you start quoting Midrashim, you're kind of doing something very similar. You're opening the door. If you're saying these words don't mean what they mean, they refer to something else. Again, let's go back to our example of the word Mashiach, right? If the word Mashiach means Messiah, meaning the future redeemer of the Jewish people, well, if I'm a Christian, I could simply say, you're right, it does refer to that, you just have the wrong redeemer. The redeemer is Jesus, and those words are telling you that the Messiah is going to come. I agree with you. I agree with your interpretation. And so, you should believe what I believe. You're just a little bit off. You're basically on the right track. Well, that is one of the factors, perhaps, that inspires Rashi and his students to say, you know what? We're actually going to go back to the Tanakh, the literal meaning of the words, the simple meaning of the words, put aside the Midrashim, and say, this is what the words mean, no allegory, no interpretation, no Mashiach, simply, this is what they mean in context, this is what they originally meant when they were written, and by doing that, you very subtly take away the Christian argument that this is referring to something else, because the words are never referring to something different, they're always only referring to themselves and to their context. I'll show you what I mean as we go along. We'll see some very, very fascinating examples. Now, again, so there's an extreme approach among the historians that says that was Rashi's only agenda. But again, even the more moderate approaches amongst the historians say, again, why does a Pshat school come into being right now? maybe something having to do with that 12th century Renaissance we were talking about, this general bubbling up of culture and interest in learning that's going on in Europe that often comes with the desire to really understand old texts. Partially a response to Christianity, partially an attempt to refute the Christian understanding of Tanakh. So let's try to understand what that means. So what we're going to do is, we have four sheets of Rashi's interpretation of Tanakh, each of which can be seen as addressing Christianity. Now, I say can be seen because, like we saw when we were talking last week, at the end of the shir last week, and also I mentioned this throughout, there's a reason that Nechama Leibovitz took the approach that she took, in which she says that Rashi never has an agenda only for the understanding of the Pesukim. Because you will see that there's often some ambiguity, and we could often read it as two ways. In other words, it'll be possible for us on occasion to read a comment by Rashi and say, oh, come on, he's got to be referring to Christianity. He's got to be somehow answering them, refuting them, whatever it is. But if you think about it, you could also say, not necessarily, this could just be literally an outgrowth of the basic, simple meaning of the text. So it's really hard sometimes to put our finger on what exactly it is that Rashi was thinking. One other thing I should point out, and that will be important as we go along, is, and this is sort of like the elephant in the room of the discussion, we said that Rashi died in 1106. 10 years before Rashi's death was the First Crusade. So Rashi lived through the First Crusade. The First Crusade was a terribly traumatic event for the Jews of Ashkenaz. It didn't impact the Jews of France as much, but for the communities in Germany, in those towns where Rashi had studied Torah, in Mainz and in Worms, and in all the towns of the Rhineland, which had been the major Torah centers, the seats of Rabbeinu Gershom and his students, those communities were terribly traumatized, possibly decimated, some of them were decimated, by the Crusaders, which means that you have people acting on behalf of Christianity who now are not just launching verbal attacks against the Jewish people, but who are also launching physical attacks, killing Jews, attacking Jews, destroying their property, and so on. One of the interesting challenges for interpreters of Rashi is to see to what extent the Crusades appear in Rashi's writings, because in his interpretations of Tanakh, he never addresses it head-on. And yet, if we read them knowing that Rashi lived through the Crusades, we may see allusions to the Crusades, but we don't know. Did he write these when he was younger, before the Crusades happened? Did he write these when he was older, after the Crusades happened? We're going to see as we go along, that's potentially part of his response to Christianity might not only be a response to their claims, but response to the fact that they had just gone off on the Jews and launched this crusade. So, here's what I want to give you here. So let's look at some examples. The first example that I gave you on the sheet comes from the 53rd chapter of Yeshayahu. The book of Yeshayahu is rife with imagery that the Christians like very much. And this passage that I gave you is one of those because it talks about a servant of God. Well, you know, let's read the Pesukim. We'll let the Pesukim speak for themselves. You don't need me here. Okay, so we give you the Hebrew and the English. The Hebrew says, Nivzev chadal ishim, ishma chalvot, he was despised and forsaken of men, a man of pains and acquainted with disease, and as one from whom men hide their face. He was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely our diseases he did bear, and our pains he carried, whereas we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. In other words, this person is carrying our problems while we were rejecting him. Think for a moment about, for the Christians, who is bearing the sins or the problems of the Jews while being rejected by the Jews, right? So the Christians, this is one of those sections of Tanakh that for the Christians, for the Christological interpretations, is very much opened up. Now, this is the next line. V'hu mecholal mipsha'enu. He was wounded because of our transgressions. Some of the Christian interpretations would say he was pierced because of our transgressions. Mecholal does not necessarily mean pierced, but in any case, that's the way they translated it. Medukame avonosenu, musar shlomenu alav uvachavuroto nir palano, but he was wounded because of our transgressions. He was crushed because of our iniquities. The chastisement of our welfare was upon him, and with his stripes we were healed. He suffered, we were healed. Kulanu katzon ta'inu, ish l'darko paninu, v'Hashem hifkia bo et avon kulanu. All of us, like sheep, did go astray. We turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord hath made him to light on him. Sorry, hath made to light on him the iniquity of us all. Okay. I'm sure you all understand, if you know anything at all about Christian theology, why it is that this, the 53rd chapter of Yeshayahu, is something that the Christians like a lot. Again, very often, by the way, the Christological interpretations are based on mistranslations or creative translations or whatever you want to say of Hebrew words. Or sometimes it's just taking things that, you know, don't necessarily apply to Jesus and say, oh, clearly if somebody is suffering for others, that must be Jesus. Really? Okay, not necessarily. But that's certainly the way the Christians are interpreting this. Now, here's Rashi's commentary, okay? Where this goes in the third pasuk where it says, Nivzev chadal ishim, right? He was despised and forsaken of men. Right? So Rashi says, Nivzev chadal ishim haya. He was. Listen to what Rashi says. Kein derech hanavi hazeh. This is the, it says here the custom, but it means this is the way of this prophet, the prophet who of Yeshayahu. Mazkir kol Yisrael ki'ish echad. He mentions all of Israel as a single person. What is Rashi saying? Who is the person who is bearing the transgressions, who is atoning for the illnesses of others? Rashi says that's a reference to the Jewish people broadly, right? Not any particular individual, certainly not that individual you might be thinking about, neighbors, right? It's a general reference to the Jewish people. And how does Rashi know? He proves it from other psukim in Yeshayahu, right? So for example, he says, Al tira avdi Yaakov, right? And now, hearken, fear not my servant Jacob, sorry. That's in the English, right? Where he says that. And he says, Hine yaskil avdi, right? And he says, my servant shall prosper. Bebeit Yaakov amar yaskil, right? In other words, so what Rashi is saying is he's showing you that there are other psukim that are clearly geared towards Bnei Yisrael on a collective level, so that when the Navi speaks as an individual, right, who, as opposed to Haim, that's just the way that Navi speaks. The Navi speaks collectively, and he refers to the Jewish people as a single, I guess, corporate entity would be the word. And so when he speaks about him suffering on our behalf, it means him, the Jews, right? And again, that's why he says, Avdi Yaakov, when God refers to the Jewish people as my servant Jacob, when he says, Hine Yaskil Avdi, right? So there are plenty of times, Rashi says, in the book of Yeshayahu, in which the Jewish people are referred to collectively as a single individual, and in this case, there is no exception. He, the person who is suffering, the person who is bearing the sins, is the Jewish people on behalf of, presumably, on behalf of humanity, right? So, if we are to read this from the perspective of the historians who say that Rashi's only agenda is to refute Christianity, here you have something very simple, right? Rashi is reading a pasuk that is very frequently quoted by Christians as talking about Jesus, who suffers on behalf of the world and humanity, and certainly on behalf of the Jews. And he's saying, no, it's not talking about that. It's talking about the Jewish people. So first of all, you could see that there's some ambiguity here, right? Because it could very well be that that's what Rashi is doing. It could also be that Rashi is genuinely looking at the book of Yeshayahu, seeing the way the prophet Yeshayahu refers to the Jewish people, and says, look, I have proof from throughout this book that this is the way the Navi speaks. This is simply his syntax, because each Navi has a separate syntax, and his syntax is to refer to the Jews collectively as one single individual. So we could make the argument that all that Rashi is doing here, is interpreting the pshat, but it's also not crazy to say when we read this that Rashi is arguing or subtly arguing against a different potential interpretation of these psukim. This would be a good example then of that subtle, the more subtle approach, right? Not quoting an argument and then knocking it out, not setting up a counter argument, simply interpreting a pasuk in a way that doesn't allow for the other potential interpretation to be applied to it. Okay, that's Rashi and Yeshayahu. And you know, again, I'm giving you like a smattering of Rashi's commentaries here and there. So throughout Yeshayahu, you can find this. There was a professor named Erwin Rosenthal who, in the 60s, I think, wrote an article where he collected what, in his opinion, he was, one of the first, who argued that you could find a lot of references to Christianity in Rashi's writings. And he collected, he went through all of Tanakh and Rashi's commentaries, and he collected many of Rashi's comments similar to this one, where he claims, no doubt about it, Rashi is responding to the Christian interpretation. So again, this is sort of tactic number one, as we saw, which is just give a different interpretation, just say that's not what this is talking about. What I want to look at now, which is the third source on the page, this is going to take us through much of the next page, Rashi's commentary on Shir HaShirim, on the Song of Songs. Because Rashi's commentary on Shir HaShirim is often held up as Rashi's response to Christianity. And in order to understand what Rashi is doing on Shir HaShirim, we do have to look at his introduction. This is unusual. I mentioned to you last week that Rashi seldom wrote introductions. He seldom wrote methodological statements. Here's what I'm going to do. Here's my approach. But when it comes to Shir HaShirim, he actually does. Why does he do that? Because Shir HaShirim always needs a methodological interpretation, because Shir HaShirim is a love song between a man and a woman that somehow made its way into the Holy Scriptures of the Jewish people, and presumably books don't just arbitrarily make their way into the Holy Scriptures of the Jewish people, right? And so the rabbis from day one have interpreted Shir HaShirim as an allegory for all kinds of things, especially for the Jewish people's relationship with God. And Rashi introduces his commentary on Shir HaShirim by saying, okay, here's a challenge before us. As you know, I'm not going to read everything. I'm just going to read the underlying parts. So what I'm telling you now is what comes before the underlying parts. As you know, every verse could be interpreted in many different ways. Throughout the Torah, the official rabbinic approach to learning Torah is that there is never one single authorized final interpretation of any pasuk. Any pasuk could be interpreted according to its simple meaning, and there are midrashim, and right, we always talk about pardes, right? Pshat, remez, drash, and so the simple meaning, and then the allegorical meaning, and then the interpretation, and then the mystical meaning. Every pasuk can be interpreted in a lot of different ways, right? But ultimately, says Rashi, every pasuk also has its literal, simple, plain meaning that defies any kind of allegory. So what I'm going to do in this commentary is try to sort of walk a fine line between the literal meaning and the allegorical interpretation of Shir HaShirim. I'm going to give you an allegorical interpretation that kind of works with the literal meaning of the words. Or I'm going to explain the words literally in a way that works with the allegorical interpretation. That's Rashi, the first part of Rashi's explanation. However, the other issue is, though, that, and Rashi himself says this, there are a lot of midrashim on Shir HaShirim. And every pasuk, if you want to know what it refers to allegorically, you'll find, you can open up, the Torah Tumima was written in the 19th century by, Rabbi Baruch Halevi Epstein, right? So it's a very handy text in that what he does is he goes according to the order of Torah, and then he gives you a lot of rabbinic commentaries on the Torah. I mean, he just tells you, he references for you the Gemaras, generally, on the Tanakh. When it comes to Shir HaShirim, he actually goes through the Midrash, the Medrash Rabbah, largely, and you'll go through any given pasuk in Shir HaShirim with the Torah Tumima, where you want to see what do the rabbis say about this pasuk, and you'll actually have a list of different things that they say. You go through the Midrash Rabbah for any given pasuk, and you'll get a list of different possible interpretations of allegorical meanings. What could this be talking about? It could be talking about, when there's some statement of love between the man and the woman. Is it talking about the Jewish people and God at the time of the Exodus from Mitzrayim? Is it talking about Avraham and God? Is it talking about the Jewish people in the time of Mashiach? All kinds of different interpretations. And Rashi here, in his introduction to Shir HaShirim, does something that he's never done for us before. He tells us his criteria. Not only does he tell us his criteria, he actually, I told you last week, he seldom allows his voice to be heard. This is actually one of the rare cases where Rashi allows his own voice to be heard, where he actually says, here's what I'm thinking. Okay, so this is where I underline. V'omer ani, I say, right? Again, you don't always hear that very often from Rashi. The part that's in the English is only the part that's underlined in the Hebrew. I didn't give you the full translation of the Hebrew, mainly because I wrote this translation myself, so I didn't want to spend time doing double the translation. So Rashi says, "Va'omer ani, I say, Shira'a Shlomo beruach hakodesh, she'atidin Yisrael legalot gola achar gola, churban achar churban." Shlomo saw prophetically the Jewish people would be exiled, exile after exile, destruction after destruction. Ulehitonein begalut ze al kvodam harishon, v'lizkor chibar rishona asher hayu segulalo mikol ha'amim. Kind of run on sentence. Leimor el chava ashuva el ishia rishon kitovli azme ata. Let's just translate now, right? And Rashi says, and in this exile, they would lament or it, the Jewish people, would lament its earlier honor and remember the early love, that they were chosen by God from all other nations. And they would say, I shall go and return to my previous husband, for it was better for me then. Quotation from a pasuk. And they shall remember his mercy and their wrongdoing and the goodness that he promised them at the end of days. And he, Shlomo HaMelech, I'm just reading the English now, established this book prophetically, utilizing the language of a woman who is bound in living widowhood, longing for her husband. Her beloved also suffers from her pain, remembering the kindness of her youth and her beauty, through which they have been bound with an eternal strong bond of love. He tells her that he did not devise this in his heart, and her alienation is not forever, is not eternal. She is still his wife, he is her husband, and he will return to her. In other words, here Rashi is telling you, here are my criteria for this is the approach I'm going to take in interpreting Shir HaShirim. Instead of quoting for you a lot of different Midrashim, I'm taking one approach. That single approach is the Jewish people in Galus, in exile, who are yearning for God, and who are reminding God of the relationship that they once had, and God's response to the Jewish people who in affirming that relationship and in saying, indeed, even if you're in exile now, even if things are bad for you now, you should know that I have not forgotten about you, that our relationship, our bond remains strong and unbreakable as ever, and that eventually we will be reunited. Again, the word that I just want to read you for a second, the Hebrew that he uses, he says, Isha tzirura al menut chayut, a woman who is bound in living widowhood. What does it mean to be in living widowhood? It means that the husband is alive, right? The woman's husband is alive, but there's, for whatever reason, some distance between them. For whatever reason, they're not together. And that's the way Rashi is envisioning the Jewish people. And it's so interesting that Rashi, in that second underlined line, he says, L'hitonein begalut zeh. In this galut, in this exile in which we find ourselves right now, in the 11th century, maybe in the early 12th century, now is when we're mourning for what once was. Now is when we're remembering the relationship with God that we had once upon a time, and we're yearning for that reconnection. So here's what we see. Rashi, what is Rashi doing here? Here again, we might have this subtle statement of the place of the Jewish people in the cosmos. The notion that even if we're in exile, even if things are not ideal, even if things are not going the way they're meant to be going, it's not because God has rejected us, and it's not because God has doomed us to eternal wandering, like we spoke about a couple of weeks ago, and it's not because God has said that you are never going to ever recover what you once had. Instead, you're going through something now, something terrible, but you should know that the actual bond between God and the Jewish people has never been severed, and that bond will eventually actually come back and will exist in the opening again, in the open once again. Once again, perhaps a response to the supersessionist claims of the Christians, to the claims that we spoke about a couple of weeks ago, in which the Christians said, because of their rejection of Jesus, Jews are doomed to wander forever, Jews are doomed to always be powerless, Jews have been rejected by God and are being punished forever and ever. It is entirely possible that that's exactly what Rashi is referring to here. Let me show you this. Turn to the next page. Look at the Shir HaShirim 2:2, right? Perek Bet Pasuk Bet, where it's a very famous imagery from Shir HaShirim. Why is it famous? Because it's in one of the earlier prakim, so people are still listening when we're reading at that point. Kishoshana ben hachochim kein rayati ben abano. Oh yeah, also famous because people have written nice tunes to this pasuk. Kishoshana ben hachochim kein rayati ben habanot. As a lily among thorns, so is my love amongst daughters or amongst girls. That's the pasuk, right? So, of course, it's meant to be to speak about the contrast, right? The one whom I love is like the lily; everybody else is like the thorns. On a simple level, what does that mean? On a simple level, of course, the young man is simply saying, you're beautiful, everybody else is, you know, kind of prickly. But what does it mean on an allegorical, on a midrashic level? How does Rashi interpret it? So Rashi explains, what's kishoshana ben hachochim? What do? Thorns, they protect. What else do? They stick, right? They hurt. So Rashi says, what's kishoshana ben hachochim? Sheminakvimota, they pierce her. Vitamid hi omedet binoya vaadmi muta. But it remains constant in its beauty and its redness, right? Just like a flower that hangs among thorns is constantly being pricked by the thorns, but remains unchanged. It's still beautiful. It maintains its color. It maintains its beauty despite having been stuck by the thorns. Kein rayati bein habanot, so too is my beloved among the daughters. What does that mean? Mifatotota, they entice her. Lirdof acharehem, they want her to pursue after them. Lizanot kemotam, to stray like them. Acharei Elohim acherim. Vehi omedet be'emunata, they entice her to pursue and to stray like them after strange gods, but she remains firm in her faith. Could be just an interpretation, an allegorical interpretation of the pasuk, or it could be the interpretation of a person who is in a society where Jews are being preached to, where the Jewish holy books are being interpreted in a way that proves the truth of some other religion, where Jews are constantly under pressure to choose that other religion, and if we could imagine the possibility, at least, and it is a possibility, that this is written after 1096, that this is written after the First Crusade, then the notion of the flower being pricked by the thorns and being enticed into pursuing other gods, changing its religion because of the thorns, you could see the possibility very strongly that Rashi's interpretation here is very much referring to his generation, to his station, and the things that they're going through from the culture that is around them. Right? That's Kishosh Ben Achim. Let me just show you one other example from Rashi's commentary on Shir HaShirim, and that is Simeni Kachotam, which means place me like a seal. Right? I didn't give you the Pesukim, right? Simeni Kachotam Alibecha, place me like a seal on your heart. So, what does Rashi say? Bishvil Ota Ahava Techatmeni Alibecha Shelo Tishkacheni, because of that love you shall seal me on your heart so that you will never forget me. V'tireki Azak HaMavet Ahava Ha'ava She'ahavticha Alay Keneged Mitati She'ani Neherag. Right, which means the love is as strong as death. The love that I have loved you is to me equal to my death, for I was killed for your sake. Here's Rashi invoking martyrdom, right? Azak hamavet ahava, love is as powerful as death. That's the pasuk, that's the line from Shir HaShirim. Rashi says, why is love as powerful as death? Not because love is such a powerful emotion, but because the love of God on by the Jewish people has resulted in actual death. It's resulted in actual martyrdom. Again, allowing for the possibility that this is written after 1096, but if not after 1096, then certainly after other points in history, Rashi is invoking what's going on in his time. He's invoking the relationship between the Jewish people and God, and he's saying, God, seal me on your heart, always keep me close to you, never forget me, because I have been killed for your sake. Kashe k'sheol kin'a, this is the last comment by Rashi, which means hatagar shenitkanu veshenitgaru bi haumot bishvilcha. This refers to the quarrel that the nations were jealous and quarreled with me because of you. In other words, ultimately, why do all these things happen? Why do the Jews suffer persecution? Because the other nations are jealous. The other nations wish they had the relationship with God that the Jewish people had. That's Rashi on Shir HaShirim. Like I said, many scholars, many historians read Rashi's commentary on Shir HaShirim as one of the clearest examples of Rashi writing about his own times, of Rashi writing about the status of the Jewish people in France during the late 11th, early 12th century. Again, possibly after the Crusades, but possibly before the Crusades, when, you know, there is still a lot of tension between the Jewish people and their Christian neighbors, at least when it comes to theological claims. Yeah, Mary. Ah, very interesting point. Okay, Mary says he's not addressing the Christians, he's addressing the Jews. That is correct. Rashi's... Okay, interestingly, there's actually an article that I did not get to use in the preparation this year called Who Was Rashi Addressing in His Commentary on Tanakh? So, you're right that it seems he's addressing the Jews, but why would he be addressing the Jews? Because part of his objective is to fortify their belief and to fortify their position and to encourage them and to tell them, you know, anything that's happening to you is happening to you for this reason. So you're right, he may not be addressing the Christians directly, but he's certainly addressing people who are subject to what's going on in the Christian culture and in the Christian milieu. That's a very important point. But it also goes to something else that we were saying, which is that sometimes Rashi is just being subtle. And, you know, we could just as easily read this, if we were to remove this from the context of 1096, if we were to remove this from the reality of martyrdom in Rashi's own time, but we knew that at some point in history Jews were experiencing martyrdom. We knew at some point in history Jews had to give up their lives for their religion, and that was testimony for the Jewish great love of God, right? We know that the story of Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva invokes, V'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha b'chol vavcha b'chol nafshecha b'chol ma'odecha. You shall love God, including with your life, at the moment of his martyrdom. So Rashi could just as easily be invoking Rabbi Akiva as he could be invoking, you know, one of his former colleagues or friends from Mainz in the 11th century. So that's the subtlety of Rashi's commentary here. And that's why, you know, even if we read it as having some historical background to it, nevertheless, there's often some ambiguity. Having said that, there are some times when in Rashi's commentary there is no ambiguity whatsoever. Let me give you an example. Zechariah 9:9. This is the second to last source on the second sheet. Gili me'od bat Zion, hari'i bat Yerushalayim, hinei malkech yavo lach, tzadik v'noshahu, ani v'rochev al chamor v'al ir ben atonot. Rejoice greatly, O daughter of Zion. Shout, O daughter of Jerusalem. Behold, your king comes to you. He is triumphant and victorious, lowly and riding upon an ass, even upon a colt, the foal of an ass. Okay, here you have the image of the king coming into Yerushalayim upon a donkey. Okay, again, ani v'rochev al chamor. He's poor and he's riding on a donkey. We know where the Christians would go with this. Here's Rashi's comment on that. Hinei malkech yavo lach. Behold, your king shall come to you. Rashi says, "Eifshar lepotro ela al melech hamashiach." It is impossible to interpret this except as referring to the King Messiah, meaning the future redeemer of the Jewish people. Shnei marbo umashlomi yam vayam, because it's going to say later, "He shall rule from sea to sea." V'lo matzinu moshel Yisrael kazeh b'yimei bayicheni. We do not find that Israel had such a ruler during the days of the Second Temple. Okay. Sometimes Rashi gets a little bit more explicit in his refutations of Christianity. That's what I want to show you. It seems this could very well be a fairly explicit response to the Christian claims. But what I want to show you now is something very cool. I want to look at some psukim and some commentary by Rashi on the second chapter of Tehillim. Again, another source that you'll see when we read it is very popular amongst Christological interpreters of Tanakh, because the imagery used in this pasuk is very much in keeping with their theology, with their belief about Jesus. And we're going to see how Rashi responds. But the question that I want you to think about is, what is Rashi doing in his commentary here? Is he, A, taking that sort of pshat, very subtle approach? If he is refuting Christianity at all, is he doing so head-on, frontally? Or is he doing so in a more subtle and gentle and roundabout way by telling you sort of right interpretation of Tanakh that will, by extension, exclude the wrong interpretation of Tanakh? So let's see what I'm talking about. Okay, so think about that question as we look at Rashi on the second chapter of Tehillim. Ready? So here's where we go. Second chapter of Tehillim says as follows. Lama ragshu goyimu ulu mim yehegurik. Why are the nations in an uproar? Why do the people mutter in vain? Yit yatzfu malche eretz v'roz nim nosdu yachtad al Hashem v'al Mashicho. The kings of the earth stand up and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed. Now remember, there's that word that we spoke about right at the beginning, right? Mashicho, the word Mashiach. The old JPS translation that you have here translates it as anointed. But of course, we all know that the word Mashiach is a very loaded word, because it also has, like most of you did, when we say, what's Mashiach? Everybody responds, Messiah. So keep that in mind as we go on, right? So here we have basically the kings of the earth ganging up on God and his anointed one, his Mashiach. What do they say? Let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us. But Yoshev Bashamayim Yischak, Adonai Yilag Lamo. He that sitteth in heaven laugheth, the Lord has them in derision. Az Yidaber Alemo V'Yapo V'Charono Yivahalemo. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and affright them in his sore displeasure. V'ani Nasachti Malki Al Tzion Har Kachi. Truly it is I that have established my king upon Zion, my holy mountain. Listen to this. Asapra El Chok, Hashem Amar Elai B'niata, Ani Hayom Yiliticha. I will tell of the decree. The Lord said unto me, you are my son. This day I have begotten you. Sha'al mimeni ve'edna goyim nachalatecha v'achuzatcha afsei aretz. Ask of me and I will give the nations for your inheritance and the ends of the earth for your possession. That's not the entire chapter of Tehillim. That's the important part that we need from now. What do the Christians say about this? Obviously, we know what the Christians say about this, right? B'niata. God said to me, you are my son. Who else could the son of God possibly be? Right? I mean, how many sons does God have? Right? So then for them, it's clear who God's son is and who God is addressing when he says, B'niata, you are my son. Moreover, this idea of the kings of the earth ganging up on God and on his anointed one, his Mashiach, his Messiah, That also, again, the notion of you know, Jesus being oppressed and dying for people's sins. So here you have a chapter of Tanakh that, according to Christian theology, very much lends itself to Christological interpretation. Here's Rashi's commentary. So first we'll start with the opening commentary. Because the opening comment on the opening pasuk, Rashi gives you context for this chapter of Tehillim. So here's what it says. Lama rakshu goyim. He says, Rabotenu darshu et ha'inyan ha'melech ha'mashiach. Our rabbis, our sages, expounded this passage as referring to the King Messiah, the future Mashiach, the Redeemer of the Jewish people. Rashi says, "Ulofi mashma'o yihyeh nachon lepotro al David atzmo." However, Rashi says, according to its apparent meaning, the simple meaning, the pshat, it is proper to interpret this as referring to David himself. And he gives examples. Ke'en shene emar, v'yishma'u plishtim ki mashchu Yisrael et David lemelech aleihem, v'yikbetsu plishtim et matineihem, v'naflu biyado, v'aleihem amar lama rakshu goyim v'nitkabtsu kulam. Right? So he gives it, so Rashi even tells you what episode in King David's life this might be referring to. The Philistines heard that they had anointed David as a king over Israel, and all the Philistines went up to seek, etc. They fell into his hands. Concerning them, he, King David, author of the Psalms, says, "Why have the nations gathered?" And they all gathered. Right? In other words, what's Rashi telling you? He's contextualizing this pasuk in the life of David HaMelech. Which makes sense to us, because we generally, traditionally assert that David HaMelech wrote the book of Tehillim. So if David HaMelech wrote the book of Tehillim, it would make sense that a chapter in Tehillim would be addressing the life of David HaMelech, right? But at the very beginning of his interpretation there, sorry? No, David did Tehillim. Shlomo did Shir HaShirim, Kohelet, Mishlei. Now, by the way, but at the very beginning, right, Rashi says, just, you know, it's sort of a little throwaway for you there. If you look at the Midrashim say that the Mashiach that's referenced here, the anointed one, is not King David, the king who had been anointed, but it's actually the Melech HaMashiach, the future redeemer of the Jewish people. Okay, that's a little throwaway for you, says Rashi. And all he's saying is, I'm not going to interpret it according to that, I'm going to interpret it according to this, right? And that's indeed what he does. He skipped down to Pasuk Zion, right? The one in which it says God addresses whoever it is and says, "You are my son." Asapra el chok, right? Rashi says, "Amar David chok katsuv hu mukabel alai l'saper zot ula hodia." Again, this is the, if you go to the English, "I will tell of the decree." Said David, "This is an established decree and one that I have received to tell this and to make it known." Namely, God says, "Hashem amar elai." God said to me. How did God say to me? Alidei Natan v'Gad u'Shmuel, through Natan, God, and Shmuel. Who are Natan, God, and Shmuel? Natan, God, and Shmuel are the three prophets who functioned during the reign of David HaMelech, right? Shmuel was one who anointed him. Natan and God were the two prophets who actually functioned during the time that he was king. So God said to me, through the prophets who functioned during my time, B'ni Ata, what does it mean, you are my son? Rashi explains, Rosh Li Yisrael HaKriyim BaTorah B'ni B'chori. Right, this is the English on the next page. What does it mean when God says, you are my, to David HaMelech, King David, you are my son? It means you are the head of Israel, who are called my firstborn son. Right? So, in other words, when God says, you are my son, it's because David is the leader of the Jews, and since the Jews are God's son, as it says in the book of Shemot, B'ni B'chori Yisrael, by definition, David is addressed as God's son, right? V'heimid kaim wal yadecha, they will endure through you. Shne'emar ba'avner, ka'amar Hashem, b'yad David avdi, oshia et ami Yisrael, u'bishvilam atal lefanai kiben shekulam tolim b'cha. Therefore, Rashi says, you are my son, because everybody is dependent upon you. So, that's what we have. Rashi, at the beginning of the chapter of Tehillim, establishes the parameters for us, he establishes the context for us. It's David HaMelech, not Mashiach of the future, and he interprets all the psukim accordingly as referring to David HaMelech and a conversation that King David had with God. Is this addressing Christianity or Christian interpretations of Tanakh? Well, again, if it is, which form of interpretation is it? It's not that sort of head-on, clear, Jews are suffering in exile kind of interpretation. It's the more subtle, this is the real meaning, so that we exclude other kinds of meanings, right? But still ambiguous. The only thing that would make us question this Rashi at all, that would make us even ask whether Rashi is interpreting this somehow, you know, as having to do with Christianity, is that little throwaway line about, our rabbis said that this has to do with Mashiach of the future, but I'm not going to do that. I'll just talk about King David. Why? presumably because if you talk about Mashiach of the future, then you're leaving it open to other people who want to interpret it about their Mashiach, who conveniently they also claim is the Son of God, which is how King David is ostensibly being answered here. So it's very subtle, not necessarily anything, right? Except for the following. This is very clear. Turn the page. And on the back of the page, you have something that I scanned and photocopied and put on the sheet for you. What this is a print edition of a manuscript version of Rashi. Remember I told you last week, or maybe 2 weeks ago, that one of the issues that we have fully comprehending Rashi's commentary is the fact that there are so many different versions, because throughout the Middle Ages it was censored, or his students made little modifications here and there, and so sometimes we want to really pin down what does Rashi believe about something. It's kind of hard, because the actual edition of Rashi, as we have it, went through some different hands and got a little edited and you know, some changes here and there. But in the manuscript versions of Rashi, there's one itty-bitty little change, a two-word addition to Rashi's introductory comment on this chapter of Tehillim that will completely change the way that we understand it, and that will show you that Rashi clearly has a theological agenda here. So I'm going to read it to you in Hebrew, and you know what you could do? I'll read you the Hebrew in the back, and if you want to follow along with the Hebrew as we have it, you'll see that there's a little subtle difference, but we'll see what the difference is. Okay, so he says, Rabotenu darshu et ha'inyan ha'melech ha'mashiach. So far it's the same, right? Our rabbis interpreted this as speaking about the King Messiah, the future Mashiach. Ulefi mashma'o, but according to its context, its simple meaning, then uletshuvat ha'minim. What does tshuvat ha'minim mean? Here's our little addition. Those are two extra words that appear in the manuscripts of Rashi that are not in the printed version of Rashi. It's correct to interpret this as talking about King David himself. What do those two words do for us? You know what the words tshuvat ha-minim means? Who are minim? Minim are rabbinic shorthand for Christianity. Christians. Exactly. A min, in rabbinic parlance, is a reference to a Christian. When you say tshuvat ha-minim, what you mean is, I am going to answer or refute the minim, the Christians, who are going to interpret this differently than I did. Those two little words that are found in the manuscript version of Rashi completely change the way we understand Rashi. If previously we thought, okay, Rashi likes Pshat, he wants to give us a simple meaning of this chapter in Tehillim, he wants to tell us that this is talking about King David because he wants to put aside the Midrashim, that's what we thought before. Here in the manuscripts we find out that the reason that Rashi put aside the Midrashim, the reason that he put aside the interpretations that say this is talking allegorically about a future Mashiach is because he wants to interpret this chapter of Tehillim in a way that it will refute the minim, refute the Christians, that it won't leave any room open for Christian interpretation. And so rather than following the rabbinic interpretation of this chapter of Tehillim that says it's talking allegorically about the Mashiach, he says, no, we're going back to the original meaning, the simple meaning. It's King David writing, and he's writing it about himself, and that's all. Why? Because if, like we said before at the beginning, if you leave it open to allegorical interpretation, then it's not only your allegorical interpretation that can be applied to these psukim, to this chapter of Tehillim, but it's also somebody else's allegorical interpretation that can be applied to these chapters of Tehillim as well. So what does Rashi say? Rather than going the allegorical, midrashic, rabbinic route here, we're going to go the simple, pshat, basic route in order to make sure that those who would interpret this allegorically, but not according to our allegory, don't even have the capacity to say anything. So this is what's cool, okay? Because this is where you see sort of this is where you see modern scholarship coming into play in our understanding of Rashi. Because if we were to just open up, you know, your standard edition of Tehillim that's printed in Makros Gedolos Tanakh with all of the rabbinic commentaries, you'll see the version of Rashi that we read before. But when you know that Rashi actually exists in a lot of different manuscripts, and you want to try to uncover some historical information about what is Rashi thinking and what are Jews thinking during Rashi's times and what's motivating Rashi occasionally, if not always, to interpret Tanakh the way that he interprets it, you find an old manuscript, you find an earlier reading of this pasuk according to the way that Rashi wrote it, which has not been censored, and then you can discover that actually there's a lot more to this pasuk than just a little monologue by King David about those who would be oppressing him, but it's actually King David monologuing, according to Rashi, in order to make sure that nobody else has the ability to interpret this chapter of Tehillim in any way. What we've seen then this evening is that sometimes Rashi takes a very subtle approach, sometimes Rashi takes a more frontal approach, but that within Rashi's commentary on Tanakh, we see his concerns for the circumstances in which he's living, the fact that Jews are living under the not only physical threat of Christianity during the Crusades, but the philosophical, theological threat of Christianity, and as Mary pointed out to us so well, in their own interpretations of the Tanakh, when they're learning Tanakh, the Jews needed the tools to be able to understand why their interpretation was correct and why the interpretations that somebody else might have been preaching in their shuls on a Saturday or on a Sunday was incorrect. And so built into his pshat commentary, Rashi includes some very subtle commentaries, some very subtle comments, and very subtle approaches that will give the Jews those necessary tools. Next week, I think we'll do our final session on Rashi. We'll talk a little bit about his legacy. We'll talk a little bit maybe about his role within the community. And then after that, maybe we'll move on.